Tell me, Amanda, what is the most annoying thing about Sarah?
She plays the role of the girl next door, and
she's not.
Honestly, she's not the girl next door.
Ooh, intriguing.
Do tell.
You know, I get a rep because of the way I look. I think it's kind of funny because maybe she's so likable because instead of at the barracks every weekend hanging out, maybe practicing her moves.
Come to mama, I want to hear this.
She's playing ring rat.
Oh!
Really?
She's a ring rat?
Skank.
Don't call me skank. I'll rip that nasty hair right out of your fucking head.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat! You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Well, there's one discussion I never thought I would hear on a WWE show. A discussion about ring rats. And Daniel Bryan asking the question, what is a ring rat? Not that he doesn't know, but he wanted Amanda to explain this. That was on Tough Talk last Tuesday, and I said it before, I'll say it again, Tough Talk is a much better show than Tough Enough. And if you did not see it, you have to go on the network last Tuesday, watch this Tough Talk, simply for the visual reaction of the judges. You can't just hear it, you have to see it, especially Daniel Bryan. Paige actually stands up. She's stunned by what she just heard. Daniel Bryan literally turns and gets up out of his chair to leave before coming back and then trying to cover his face. You could tell, you know, poor Daniel Bryan would rather be anywhere in the world but there having a discussion about ring rats. If anybody did not belong as part of that conversation, it's probably Daniel Bryan. But that was Tough Talk. We are headed into the final week of Tough Enough, which I'll talk about in just a second. But first, this is episode 397 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, in case you didn't know what you were listening to. Here for Saturday, August 22nd, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. The finale of Tough Enough is this Tuesday on USA Network. It is the final episode. It has come down to Josh and ZZ for the men, Amanda and Sarah Lee for the women. We have found out that all four participants are going to have their first live in-ring matches on Tough Enough. It'll be Cesaro wrestling Josh and ZZ individually. And I believe Alicia Fox is the one wrestling Amanda and Sarah Lee. So that'll be very interesting. If this is happening live, there's no room for editing. There's no room for, really, no margin for error. It's sink or swim. And then they will pick one man and one woman who will each win a $250,000 developmental contract for WWE. So now that we're down to the final episode, I know I've talked about this before, who I thought should win. Who I thought should win? They've been gone for weeks because I thought Mata had a real chance, but originally I think I picked, was it Patrick? Or was that after Pat? I think Patrick was already eliminated, and I think I said that Mata and Gigi were the ones who were most ready to join, who I thought would be best, and they were both dumped, thanks to the fans. So now we're left with what we're left with. Obviously, Josh, of the two, is more ready. Josh deserves to win. Does that mean he will? You know what? I think he is going to win. I think Josh is going to win, unless ZZ blows everybody away. If Cesaro makes ZZ look like the second coming of Bret Hart, then I guess ZZ has a shot in winning. But unless he blows people away by this match and Josh just botches things left and right and has a bad night, Josh now has won the fan vote over ZZ twice. There was always somebody else who was in the bottom three, and that person was eliminated, which is why ZZ is still around. But this past week, Josh got a higher vote, second time that's happened, than ZZ. So I really don't think ZZ has much of a chance. I think Josh wins it. And for the women, I think it's Sarah Lee. I mean, how could it not be? Look at the way that they were positioning these women on the show last week. Some of the things they were showing, the footage of Amanda scheming and saying all these nasty things to Sarah Lee. They've turned Sarah Lee into such a sympathetic character, and that's been done by design. That's how they've edited the show. Even if the WWE people would rather not give her a $250,000 contract, maybe Amanda has the look that you would expect to come from a WWE diva, but She's got virtually no chance. Again, unless Sarah Lee just completely shits the bed in that match with Alicia Fox. If she hurts herself or hurts Alicia or just can't get her head straight, that could be the end for her, I guess. But as things stand right now, I think it's pretty obvious it's going to be Josh and Sarah Lee. We'll see. Tuesday night. Thank you to everybody who has been signing up for the Audible trial for the Daniel Bryan book. Or for other books. Can't say that everybody's been downloading their free Bryan book as their one free book. Some people maybe have been getting some of the other wrestling books they have on there. There's a ton of different ones for you to choose from. We've had a really good summer so far. I want to end August on a high note. Need more people to take advantage. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster. I think you're really going to enjoy the service. You get 30 days to try it out. If you don't like it, you can cancel at any time. You won't be billed. You get to keep one free audiobook. You get that no matter what. The moment you sign up and you are officially an Audible member, even if just for the trial period, you get one free book that you can pick. It could be any book they have. And that includes the new Daniel Bryan book. So get on that. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster. Use our URL. Go through the sign-up process. Get your free book. Let me know what you think of the book after you're done with it. And you can take advantage of that right now. Also, we have that new Whistling Dixie shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tees store, one of 21 shirts in our store, prowrestlingtees.com/Solemonster Sounds Off. They ship all over the world, up to a size 5XL. So please check that out. And last but not least, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on the Solemonster.com. $10 or more will get your wrestling nickname. And a shout-out this week to Hot Stuff Hector Pena, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Deadpool James Herrera, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Dwayne Rainmaker Reebling, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, and Sinister Joe Meyer. Thank you very, very much for your donations this week. Again, thesolemonster.com is the place to go for that. I am headed out in a few hours to the Barclays Center for NXT TakeOver. This will be my second NXT show. I'm very excited. Had a lot of fun at the one in San Jose as part of WrestleMania weekend earlier this year. That was a much smaller building. So this is going to be very, very different because this is a 13,000... Actually, it's a lot bigger than 13,000, but they've allotted 13,000 seats. 13,400, I believe, is the number of people who will be in attendance tonight for this show. Far beyond the 6,000 that they had originally budgeted, I guess you could say, for this show. And when that initial allotment sold out instantly, they said, well, let's open it up to the rest of the building. And so that's what they did. I don't know that the show is officially sold out. They may claim that it is. When I went on Ticketmaster to take a look yesterday, it said very few seats available. So there's still tickets to be had if you look. But it'll mostly be sold out. And I was having this conversation the other day, actually, with a friend at an indie show. We were talking about this because he's going to the Ring of Honor show, which is competing with... Or I should say NXT is competing with the Ring of Honor show because ROH booked Brooklyn first. But he's going to the ROH show. We were talking a little bit about this. And he brought up an interesting point. He thought that maybe NXT was growing a little too fast. And that was a concern. You know, he likes NXT, but it's getting very big very quickly. We both would have loved to have seen NXT in a building like the Hammerstein Ballroom. I know why they did it. Why would you book a 2,500-seat building that looks tiny on TV when you can book the Barclays Center and sell a shit ton more tickets? They've got like a $700,000 advance on the gate. I totally understand why they did it. From a business perspective, it would have been foolish for them not to. But I do think there's something to be said for having a show like this. You know, NXT, it's not underground, but it's kind of... I'm trying to figure out the right way to phrase this. You don't want to think that NXT is bigger than it actually is and get into the habit of, hey, let's book bigger buildings because we booked 13,000 people in Brooklyn, so let's go to another big market like LA or Chicago and we'll book a 10,000 seat building. Look, maybe they can sell it out, maybe they won't. I think it's smart doing it in conjunction with a big pay-per-view like SummerSlam. That way, it's almost a surefire way to get a big crowd or sell out. So it was very smart. It's cool for them to be able to say, hey, we've done something that nobody else has ever done, or at least no other wrestling company has ever done, which is we've taken this big building and we've sold it out back to back to back, three nights in a row, right? That's going to be a did you know fact, I'm sure, for years to come. But I do think when you have a show like this, these NXT shows in the smaller buildings, and I don't mean like 500 people, like they make the loop in Florida, they run these very tiny buildings. You can do a building like in San Jose that fit 5,000 people. They had like 4,800 people there. And it makes for a much more electric atmosphere. Hopefully the Barclays Center is rocking tonight. Look, it's Brooklyn. We're getting our first NXT show. I think it'll be a hot crowd. Is it going to be hot for the whole time? I don't know. And that crowd can really make or break a show. So I hope that they go out there. I hope that everybody is loud. I hope it comes across on TV. But I would like to see them run specials in smaller buildings too, just because I think it makes for a more fun atmosphere. But I thought, again, my friend made an interesting point. Are they growing too fast too soon? I guess time will tell. If they stop selling tickets, then I guess the answer is yes. And if they can keep selling out buildings, I guess the answer is no. Some new notes on the card tonight. Kaz and Enzo are wrestling. They're just not wrestling on the live takeover special. They're part of an eight-man tag being taped before the show. It's going to air on NXT this Wednesday. It'll be I don't know if the NXT show that's airing on Wednesday on the network is going to be 90 minutes, but they're saying that it's effectively 90 minutes worth of matches that they're taping tonight before they go on the air at 9 o'clock. So it could be an expanded episode of NXT next Wednesday. I guess we'll find out. But it's going to be Kaz and Enzo teaming with Zack Ryder and Mojo Rawley against Scott Dawson, Dash Wilder, Jason Jordan, and Chad Gable. Very excited to see Chad Gable live. Also, Bull Dempsey with his new Bull Fit gimmick against Elias Sampson, Carmella against Eva Marie, which sounds like the blind leading the blind there. That match could end up being a freaking disaster. Thankfully, I'll be there live to see it, so that when it airs on TV next week, I'll be able to let you guys know how much editing they end up having to do to that match. And Becky Lynch, Charlotte, Emma, and Dana Brooke in a fatal four-way. Those are the matches being taped beforehand. Then they go live on the network at 9 p.m. I already did my predictions last weekend, so we've covered that. And, you know, isn't it interesting how many guys and how many girls they've tried to fit on that card tonight, whether it's the pre-show or the actual special? And nowhere on the card is Solomon Crowe. I talked about him last week, how it's just not working, whatever they're doing with him, and they've already tweaked the character once or twice since he debuted. It's just not working, and they know that. They know it's not working, or else he would be on the card tonight. And it's very telling that he's not, especially him being a CZW guy, working a lot on the East Coast. And here they are, up in the Northeast. You would think he's one of those guys, like Samoa Joe. He's on the card tonight. You would think they would want a guy like Solomon Crowe on the card. No Solomon Crowe. My plan right now is to get my SummerSlam review up on the YouTube channel on Monday, and then maybe get a review for TakeOver up on YouTube the day after that, so that way I'm not waiting an entire week to review the show. So now would be a good time to hit the subscribe button on our YouTube channel if you haven't already done so, youtube.com/thesolomonster. There'll be at least one, if not two, new videos going up in the next few days. SummerSlam night at MCU Park here in Brooklyn. I was there on Wednesday night. They had Ryback, Fandango, Charlotte, and Eva Marie there to play in a celebrity softball game before the Brooklyn Cyclones game that night. Ryback did not play because I guess, you know, he just came back from the staph infection. I think he did an interview. He was saying how last year he had a bad shoulder injury. So, not to say that he's injury prone, but I guess they said, listen, they don't want you playing baseball. So, he was a coach on the sidelines, but the other three did play. It was fascinating watching Eva Marie fielding and running the bases. All these pictures, by the way, and some video that I shot is up on my Twitter page on Wednesday, at Solomonster. I was on the field for some media stuff before the game when they were all just kind of hanging around. I bumped into a guy with a Total Divas backpack. It said like Total Divas Bunham Murray Productions, which I think is the production company for the show. So they may have filmed part of this for Total Divas, I'm not sure. I should have asked one of the WWE people there, but it wasn't that pressing for me to find out. Peter Rosenberg from Hot 97 was the main casualty in the softball game. He suffered a separated shoulder running down a fly ball. Yes, he separated his shoulder while chasing down a fly ball in the outfield. He collided with Mike Woods. Mike Woods is the weatherman from Fox 5, Channel 5 here in New York, who is in incredible shape, by the way. I already knew this because I met him before, but the dude is fit. He is in shape. So I'm not surprised that Mike Woods came out of it with just a scraped knee, and Rosenberg was the one who basically disintegrated upon impact, landed right on his shoulder. I was amused by Mike Woods mocking Rosenberg's injury on TV the next morning. They even put a picture of him in the hospital up on the screen, and they all laughed at him. It was all in good fun, of course. I shouldn't laugh because I had my own little mishap the next night, although not as bad as a separated shoulder. But that leads into the indie show I went to on Thursday night. It was Five Borough Wrestling from the American Legion Hall here in Brooklyn. This is my second FBW show this year. I had a lot of fun both times. I've said this on the podcast before. If you've never been to an independent wrestling show before, and a lot of you have not, because every time I say this, I hear from you, go, oh, you know, indie shows never come to my area. Some of you have said that they have come to your area, and then you decided to go and you had a blast. Even if it's not coming to your town, if there's one nearby, if you have to drive half an hour, if you've never been to an independent wrestling show, you know nothing other than WWE or, God forbid, TNA, go, because you're going to have fun. It's not expensive. You'll have a good time. The big draw on this show was an appearance by the Young Bucks. Very polarizing team, apparently. There doesn't seem to be a lot of middle ground on these guys. People either love them, or they fall into the Jim Cornette camp of hating them or hating what they represent. Not quite sure what that is, but I guess some people feel they represent everything that's wrong with pro wrestling. I disagree, but that's what some people think. I'm a fan of their work. I think they're very talented. I think they're a lot of fun to watch. You know, I mean, come on. What's wrong with having some fun? The undercard was fun. There's a team called Milk Chocolate. They're a lot of fun to watch. Amazing Red was there. He lost to JT Dunn. And then I know Red wrestled Rey Mysterio at another indie show last night. I actually don't even know what happened in that match. I haven't looked up the results. But I know that was a very big deal to Amazing Red to wrestle Rey Mysterio. Brian Myers, the former Curt Hawkins, beat the Greek god Papadon to win the FBW heavyweight title. So Brian Myers is the new champion. And then there was, I think it may have been a five-person scramble match. I think that's what it was. And one of the five guys in that scramble match is a man by the name of Stockade. Some of you, if you live in the New York area, may have heard of him before. You could look him up online. He also happens to be the current NYWC heavyweight champion. He is an enormous man. Every bit of 350 pounds, maybe 400. I'm terrible at guesstimating that kind of stuff, so maybe I'm packing on a few extra pounds here, but every bit of 350, no doubt in my mind. He came to the ring wielding a baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire. The guy's crazy. Anyway, during the match, he was thrown out of the ring, and he landed right in front of me. So I'm on that side of the ring in the front row. He falls outside. I think what happened next was one of the guys in the ring may have delivered. He came off the ropes and delivered a drop kick through the ropes, hit Stockade, and that sent him flying backward into the metal guardrail. Okay, and there wasn't that much space between the guardrail and the ring. So he gets hit with this drop kick. Big guy just falls backwards right into the guardrail. And that metal guardrail then smashed into my legs. And for a moment there, I had a flashback to that scene with James Caan and Kathy Bates in Misery. I think you know the one I'm talking about. He just destroyed this fucking guardrail to the point where a guy had to come out during the match just to hold it up because this thing was falling over and they couldn't get it stable. So this guy had to just stand there like an idiot holding it for the rest of the match. The thing was all bent, it was all mangled. It was actually very impressive, I have to say, the damage that this guy did to this guardrail. It also made me appreciate why WWE uses those black barricades now instead of the old metal ones. I was always a fan of the old metal ones. Remember they did that Raw old school show like 5 years ago, and they had the red, white, and blue ropes, they had the old metal barricades. I like that look, but I have a newfound appreciation for why WWE doesn't use them anymore. It slammed right into my knees. I didn't check until after the show, but, you know, bleeding, the whole deal. Now I got to figure out how to, you know, get blood out of the interior of one's jeans. But I hobbled home. I put, you know, like an ice pack on each knee. I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm like, ugh. So I put ice packs on each knee. The next morning, as I figured, it just fucking sucked waking up the next morning. I mean, it's fine now. It's still a little sore. The thing is, I cracked my shin on a shopping cart. Don't ask me how. About 3 months ago. So I was more concerned when it happened that I, like, re-aggravated that. But it was the knees, not the shins. So at least that was the good part of the whole thing. So the show goes on. There was a point, actually in that match, where the Big O, and if you ever watch Zack Ryder's Z True Long Island Story, you know exactly who the Big O is. And I still say he never should have been cut on that Tough Enough casting special. I think that was a mistake. I mean, put it like this. Do you even remember the name of the first guy who got eliminated from Tough Enough, like on that first episode when the show started? Because I don't. You mean to tell me there was no place for the Big O on that show, but they put that guy on there? Anyway, I didn't know they were doing an angle. Apparently they've been doing an angle for a few months where the Big O has been banned from the promotion by the evil forces, and he did a run-in during the match and came through the crowd, through my section, right up behind us, just like a bat out of hell, trying to kill one of the guys in the ring, but he got stopped right in front of me. The staff, the other wrestlers, they're like trying to hold him back. He's a big guy, trying to hold him back. I'm sitting there trying to protect my knees, like, for the love of God, please do not fall backwards, whatever you do. They're like holding him. They're about to fall over. I'm like, please, please, for the love of God, just don't fall backwards. It was quite the scene. It was quite the scene. And then the Young Bucks wrestled the Beaver Boys in the main event. Super kicks for everybody. Meltzer driver for the win. A good time was had by all. They're coming back to Brooklyn again next month with Kevin Nash, of all people. He'll be in a tag team match. And one of Kevin Nash's opponents, Stockade. Big Sexy better be careful. If he does to Kevin Nash's knees what he did to my knees, this may be the last time we ever see Kevin Nash inside a wrestling ring. SummerSlam is tomorrow night, or so I hear. At the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, they have Jon Stewart hosting the show, which is actually a pretty big coup for them. Him coming off the Daily Show just ended after 16, or at least the Daily Show with him. Just ended after, what, 16 years, I think. That was kind of a big deal, you know, him just having his last show. And this is the first public thing he is doing since leaving The Daily Show. We saw him earlier this year. He came in. He was a Raw guest host, did a little angle with Seth Rollins, and was really good. I mean, he was on the mic. He did a promo. He did a better promo than 90% of the people that they would stick a mic in their hand on the roster right now. I mean, he was a natural. If he really, I mean, I know he's a big wrestling fan. If he was like a sick wrestling fan who wanted to actually have something to do with WWE, they'd be insane not to bring him in and give him an on-air role of some kind on the show. Make him the authority figure. It'd be nice to have a babyface authority figure for a change instead of whatever the fuck the authority is. They go back and forth between babyface and heel every week. I don't know what they're supposed to be. But let's go through the card here. We will start from the top and just work our way through the undercard. Of course, the main event of this show is Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker. That is your main event. A lot of debate about how this is going to go. Is there going to be a fuck finish? How many fuck finishes will there be on this show? I don't know that there'll be as many as you may think. And by fuck finish, I'm talking like a DQ or a countout or a no decision. I think there'll be a couple, but I mean, I don't see them, you know, for example, ending both main events without there being a clear-cut winner. I think there will be a winner. And I think in the Undertaker match, it's going to be the Undertaker. And I would not have said that a few weeks ago, because I thought, okay, maybe they go with Brock Lesnar and they build to a third and final match with these two guys at WrestleMania next year, with Undertaker finally getting the win back. Because they've been playing that up in the storyline, right? Undertaker never beating Brock, which is true. And then they save it for Mania next year. Because you don't want Undertaker losing another Mania match. But the more I think about this and I see how they've set things up and, you know, Undertaker kicking this guy in the balls every week and what it could be leading to, I'm going to go with Undertaker. I think that we get the return of Kane in this match. A lot of you guys have emailed me, hey, do you think Kane is going to come back with the mask? I do, actually. He's ready to come back any week now. He's going to be back on TV. I know he was filming some stuff for a movie with Dolph Ziggler. That movie that Ziggler was off filming up in Vancouver, I think it was. Kane also has a role in that movie. In fact, I think Kane might be his superior. I think Dolph is like a cop, and Kane is like his captain. I got to see this movie. So anyway, he's done with all of his commitments. Although, if Kane does come back, I have to say, for a guy that supposedly shattered his ankle, he'd be coming back awfully quick. But I do think we get the return of Kane. I think he'll be back in the mask. Probably the more recent mask, not the old Kane mask that we all love. I think he attacks Brock Lesnar, gives his brother the assist, and that leads to The Undertaker, probably a tombstone or something, and he wins the match, thanks to his brother. Now, a couple of things on this. First, I thought about the possibility that maybe Kane does come back, but he comes back and gets involved not in the Undertaker match, but he gets involved in the championship match, and not this one, because they've built that feud up between Kane and Seth Rollins for months now. We know Kane doesn't like Rollins, and it was Rollins who stomped on Kane's broken ankle the last time we saw him on TV. So whenever Kane does come back, Rollins is going to be in big trouble. But it makes more sense, I think, for him to come back here in this match because it was Brock Lesnar who actually broke Kane's ankle. That's number one. And also, I'd like to think that Paul Heyman doesn't say things in his promos without there being a reason behind it. That they have him saying certain things because they have a plan. I know that's asking a lot, but I'd like to think that. Before that happened, multiple times, in fact, on TV, Heyman brought up the fact that The Undertaker was Kane's older brother, right? He said that at least twice on television, different weeks. And every time he would mention it, Kane would get very angry. Kane would get pissed off. He is apparently very touchy about people talking about his family. The other thing is also Heyman has played up the fact that The Undertaker has never beaten Brock Lesnar one-on-one, which is true. Never has, even back in 2002, 2003. I have to think that those things were said for a reason, the Kane family stuff and the fact that, hey, Undertaker's never beaten Brock before. There's got to be a reason for that. And so that's why I think Undertaker is going over in this match. Now, speaking of Brock Lesnar, I want to mention this here. Lesnar was on SportsCenter this week as part of ESPN's coverage of SummerSlam, which is huge for them. I mean, I still remember an interview that D'Lo Brown did back during the Attitude Era with some magazine. It may have been WWF Magazine. And why I remember this, don't even ask me. But he said one day he would love to see ESPN covering pro wrestling like they do other sports. That was like one of his dreams. As a pro wrestler, I would love to see ESPN covering us the way they cover baseball and basketball and football and all these other sports. And here we are 15 years later, and it's actually happening. I mean, at least for this weekend. Maybe not next weekend, but for this weekend, they're covering this like a real sport. You look at some of these segments on the website, on TV, it's amazing. I never thought I would see the day. Brock came out for an interview on SportsCenter. The best part about this, he did the full Brock entrance. He walks out, he's bouncing back and forth, throws his arms up in the air. I was a little disappointed, no pyro when his arms came down, but what are you going to do? They asked him about the Dana White tweets, where Dana White called wrestling fake and wrestling fans lost all control of their motor functions. I was attacked for what I tweeted, which I didn't think was anything offensive. You know, when this whole thing happened, I couldn't believe that people were making that big of a deal about it. It was a Twitter reply. You would think that Dana White went on like a random Twitter tirade about pro wrestling, which he didn't do. And all I said was, listen, it's not a big deal. And, you know, hey, by the way, the Easter Bunny isn't real either. People lost their shit. Other people freaked out over Dana's comments, too. Seth Rollins tweeted about it. Bully Ray said, oh, Dana White should apologize for his comments. And they're wrestlers. Okay, they're in the middle of it. They're more entitled, you know, more than entitled to feel the way that they feel about it if they so choose, okay? I bring this up, though, because Lesnar was asked about it, and he said, and I quote, well, of course it's fake. Everybody knows that. That's what Brock Lesnar said. No reaction. No reaction. Where were those same people who tweeted at Dana White? Where was Seth Rollins? Where was Bully Ray? And Taz and all the other people? All these people who were offended by what Dana White said. There's only two explanations I can come up with for people's silence on this. One, to them, it's fine for people in the wrestling business to say something like that, but it's not okay for somebody outside the wrestling business to use that word and say something like that. Or the only other explanation I can come up with, and this is the one I'm leaning toward, it's Brock Lesnar who said it. And these people want to have a high life expectancy, and wisely, they kept their mouth shut. That's the one that I'm going to go with. Brock did say he thinks Vince McMahon is a better promoter than Dana White, and he said some other stuff, but he used the dreaded F word, and not a peep from anybody. Which is great, because like with Dana, him saying it, it's not a big deal. I didn't freak out. Brock used the word, so what? It's not a big deal. It wasn't a big deal then. It's not a big deal now. So I'm cool with the fact that this seems to have just gone over everybody's heads. I'm not saying people should have made a big deal about it, other than the fact that it makes them look like a hypocrite. People can be awfully selective about the things they get upset about. We have Seth Rollins and John Cena. Winner take all for the WWE Championship and the United States Championship. I'm going to go with Seth Rollins. He's my pick in this match. I don't think that either guy is losing their respective title. I think when this show is over, Rollins is going to be the WWE champion. John Cena is going to be the U.S. champion. But I think Rollins ends up getting the win. I'm going to say that Sheamus cashes in. He makes it a three-way just like at WrestleMania when Rollins himself cashed in. And the way it all goes down is I could see a scenario where Rollins steals the pin from John Cena on Sheamus, maybe after, you know, Cena lays out Sheamus with like a super AA or something, and Sheamus is down, and Rollins steals the pin and gets the win. And this all sets up Sheamus now as John Cena's next challenger for the U.S. title, which I'm sure now there's a collective, like, oh my God, a collective groan from everybody at the idea. But I could see them setting that up as the next big feud for John Cena and that U.S. title. Anything to keep Sheamus away from the WWE title. I don't hate Sheamus. I have no interest in seeing him with that championship. I don't even know why they gave him the briefcase. It's just, I have zero interest in seeing him with that top title right now. Wrestling for it, holding it, breathing on it, staring at it, anything with it. Him and Cena for the U.S. title, fine. Put them together, let them feud over that belt. That's my attitude about it. And it's not a Sheamus hate, it's just, I just don't have the desire to see him wrestling for the championship and being in the opening 20-minute promo segment and wrestling in main events every single week. I just don't want to see it. So, you know, to me, that's how they get out of putting the U.S. title on Rollins. Rollins doesn't need the U.S. title. If they put the U.S. title on Rollins, it's a complete waste. And if they put the WWE title on Cena, even if just for a few minutes and then Sheamus cashes in or something and wins it, first of all, what a waste of a 16th title reign for John Cena. But to put the championship back on John Cena, you're going back to the same well. I like what they've done with the guy. They've taken him out of the world title picture. He had a good thing going with that open challenge stuff. I mean, you knew the open challenge couldn't go all year. But if that's the end of it, I'm pretty disappointed, because that's been one of the highlights of Raw the entire year, or at least ever since WrestleMania. He had a good thing going. To put the world title back on him, to me, is a failure on their part. Anytime they have to put that championship from here on out back on John Cena, it is a sign of failure. And it's a sign of them not having faith in anybody else on that roster to carry the ball. So I think Cena getting the belt back would be a colossal mistake. And I don't think they're going to make that mistake. I think they're going to keep the titles right where they are. And Sheamus is going to get involved in some way. Now, how do you get around the fact that on Raw Monday, you know, the Authority promised to create a bronze statue for Seth Rollins if he won? If I remember, I think it was that if Rollins wins and gets both belts, they will create a statue. Maybe that could be their way out of it. Because if Rollins pins Sheamus, he doesn't win the U.S. title. I mean, I know the match is winner take all, but that kind of changes once Sheamus gets involved. That's my rationale behind it. I know it sounds a little convoluted. Maybe it's just wishful thinking on my part to get that freaking briefcase off that guy. We don't need another year of somebody carrying the briefcase around. It's okay for them to cash in early. But I'm going to stick with that as my prediction. Rollins wins. Dean Ambrose and Roman Reigns against Bray Wyatt and Luke Harper. I'm going to go with Bray Wyatt and Luke Harper because I don't think this is the end of the feud. And I don't think that Ambrose is turning heel on Roman, at least not on this show. It may happen at some point. In fact, I'm almost positive it will. I said last week, right, in wrestling, if you have a best friend or a brother, literal brother, that doesn't last very long. At some point, somebody turns... everybody turns on everybody at some point. That's how things work in pro wrestling. I just don't think that we're going to see that on this show. And I think this is not the last match that we're going to see these guys in. And I just think Wyatt and Harper are going to go over here. Kevin Owens and Cesaro. This could be the show stealer. I'm really looking forward to this match. Hopefully Owens comes out of that ladder match tonight to take over unscathed. And he can go in there and have a kick-ass match with Cesaro tomorrow night. You know, as far as who needs the win more, I'm going to say Kevin Owens needs the win more. Losing on this show will not kill Cesaro. If Cesaro goes out there and has a high-profile SummerSlam match and they give them 15 minutes and they tear the fucking house down and people are chanting, this is awesome, and they're going out of their minds, and Cesaro does all of his power spots and looks impressive but then loses or gets screwed in the end, he doesn't lose anything. As long as he doesn't then drop a few spots back down into mid-card hell. You know, they've been pushing him lately. They've been featuring him in big matches and main events on Raw and on SmackDown. They have to keep that going. He doesn't have to win here, but they have to keep that momentum going. And I think a competitive match with Kevin Owens, a loss, is not going to kill Cesaro. But Kevin Owens, I don't think he's walking out of TakeOver as the new NXT champion. And Kevin Owens, it seems like, has lost a lot more than he has won in the last couple of months. If he loses a big match tonight, that makes two big matches in a row, back-to-back nights in the same building that he would be losing. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think Kevin Owens needs the win more. I think he'll get the win. He's my pick. We have Randy Orton and Sheamus. I think Sheamus is going to win, even if he does go and cash in. And you know, if he cashes in, my prediction is he doesn't cash in successfully. So he can win here, lose later. And it really doesn't matter who wins this match, to be honest with you, but Sheamus is my pick. Dolph Ziggler and Rusev, one-on-one. Ziggler is back. We'll talk about that in the Raw review here in a second. I think that Rusev gets the win, leading to another match between them, or more likely a mixed tag at the next pay-per-view. But I feel like to really keep things going, Rusev has to look dominant. I suppose he can lose maybe by DQ, but I think he's going to win. And I think this is not this is far from the end of this feud, even if he does win. Ryback, Big Show, and Miz, triple threat for the Intercontinental Championship. I think Ryback is going to retain. We have Team Bella against Team Bad against Team PCB. Three-way elimination match. When one member of a team is eliminated, the entire team is gone. So thankfully, this is not Survivor Series. Every single person has to be eliminated style. I'm going to go with Team Bella. It feels to me like Nikki Bella's been losing quite a bit, even Brie. On TV recently. I know Nikki just tapped out to Sasha Banks on Monday. I think Nikki's been pinned or has tapped out to Charlotte as well. I think they want to put some momentum back in the Bella camp. So I think if, you know, Team Bad can go out there, Sasha could have a good show, Charlotte and Becky could have a good show, get a big reaction in Brooklyn. But in the end, I think Team Bella wins. It's probably Nikki getting that final pin, too. She's the champ. She's got to look dominant at some point. So I think Team Bella. Not who I would want to win the match, but I think that they're the ones who are going to pick up the win. We have primetime players, New Day, Los Matadores, and the Lucha Dragons, Fatal 4-Way for the tag team titles. I think the New Day get the belts back. The New Day has to get the belts back. I wouldn't have taken the belts off them in the first place. But it's time to put the belts back on the New Day. And we have Neville and Stephen Amell teaming up against Stardust and King Barrett. I think it's pretty obvious the superheroes are going to get the win here, so Neville and Amell are my pick. Stephen Amell, by the way, has released a special Amell vs. Stardust t-shirt for SummerSlam. He collaborated with WWE on this to help raise money for charity. 100% of the proceeds from the sale of this shirt will go to Emily's House, which is a hospice for sick children. They've already raised over $80,000, which is awesome. It's for a good cause. And not for nothing, you know, it's a pretty cool-looking shirt. It's only going to be available through Monday. Once Raw ends, the shirt disappears, so you only have a couple days left if you want one. I ordered mine already. I think it's a cool-looking shirt. They won't start shipping until September 9th, so just be aware it may be up to a month before you actually get the shirt in the mail. But take a look at it. If you like it, it's one of these three-quarter sleeve deals. If you want it, you can go to represent.com/AmelStardust. That's the place to go. represent.com/AmelStardust, all one word. That's one M in Amel, not two. It's a really cool thing I think he's doing. He's obviously, you know, he's a lifelong wrestling fan. He's taking this very seriously. I'm digging it. This is an example of celebrity participation that I can get behind. I think he may surprise a lot of people at the pay-per-view tomorrow night, too. I mean, he's a good athlete. You saw that just in that one appearance he made. I know he does parkour shit and all this other stuff. Works out, keeps himself in good shape. But I still think he's going to surprise some people tomorrow night. And that's the SummerSlam card. That's 10 matches strong right there. They may bump one of them to the pre-show. Or maybe they'll add an 11th match to the pre-show. But that's a pretty stacked lineup they have there. I'm looking forward to both shows this weekend. I think they're both going to turn out to be quite good. As far as, you know, which one do I think is going to be better? It's hard. You know, under normal circumstances, I'd probably just say NXT. Especially if they go out there. They're going out there first. So they'll have the benefit of being the first show. Maybe the crowd is going to be hotter for that show than they will be for the pay-per-view or for Raw Monday night. So maybe they have that added benefit. But I think, I don't know, I think SummerSlam will turn out to be the better show, but that doesn't mean I think TakeOver is going to be, you know, garbage or anything like that. I think we're going to get a lot of good wrestling this weekend. Let's talk about Raw. Just kind of blast through this here. Raw Monday night, the go-home show to SummerSlam, was live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And speaking of Minneapolis, may as well mention this here. It's kind of a big news note this week. In a video on the Minnesota Vikings website talking about the new stadium that they're building, U.S. Bank Stadium, which is set to open next year, I think in July. The team's vice president very casually mentioned in this video that WrestleMania is going to be held there. He basically confirmed that WrestleMania is coming to their city. He didn't say which WrestleMania, he didn't say which year. One would think he meant WrestleMania 33 in 2017, but who knows, it could be 34. Minneapolis was one of the rumored sites for a upcoming WrestleMania. I've heard Orlando, I've heard Philadelphia being the other two locations. I mean, those may well be the next three locations for WrestleMania, just not necessarily in that order. But watching that video, Minnesota is apparently confirmed, although WWE hasn't said anything. I can't imagine that they are too thrilled with him making a comment like that before they have a chance to make the announcement themselves. I was reading up on the new stadium. Didn't know too much about it. 73,000 is the listed maximum capacity it'll be able to fit for non-football events. You figure with the giant WrestleMania stage they normally have, it'll probably be a little bit less than that, which I'm sure is no problem for WWE. That will not stop them from claiming at least 5,000 more than whatever the actual number is. Some WrestleManias has actually been 10,000 more that they've claimed. Stadium has a translucent roof that'll let light shine through, movable windows that they claim will allow for a little bit of that outdoor Minnesota experience. Is that supposed to be a selling point for visitors? Because it's not for me. I've already got my airfare booked for Dallas next year. I'm sure it'll be a little bit warmer there than it will be in Minneapolis. So that's your WrestleMania update. I enjoyed Cesaro and Randy Orton against Kevin Owens and Sheamus and the way they positioned Cesaro for the multiple hot tags in that match. It was Randy Orton tagging him in, not the other way around. Lots of Cesaro section signs, which seems to be a weekly occurrence now. Crowd was loud for him into all his big moves. You might even say that Cesaro is, dare I say, connecting with the crowd. Who would have known? We had a very stiff match between Roman Reigns and Luke Harper, thanks primarily to Harper. Maybe stiff isn't even the right word, because that would imply he was really beating the crap out of Roman Reigns. I'm sure he protected him just fine. He's just that good that everything he does looks like it hurts. It hurt me to watch this guy wrestle. That's how brutal his offense looks. Harper, I think, is one of the more underrated guys, maybe the most underrated guy in all of certainly WWE, but I think he's probably also one of the more underrated guys in all of wrestling right now. It's very easy to look at guys on the indies, or even in TNA or ROH, and say, hey, you know, this guy has a good body, he's got six-pack abs, he's got a good look, and he can work. This guy's so underrated. I think because Harper dresses like a slob and doesn't have a real impressive physique, at least not one that you can tell because he wears a shirt, it's very easy to forget how talented he really is and the things he can do for a bigger guy. He's very, very good, and I hope they realize what they have in him and that he isn't dressed in a dirty shirt for the rest of his career, because I think he's a lot better than that. They had a preview for the newest episode of Total Divas on Eva Marie that said, and I quote, this is what the narrator said, "She's always been loved by the fans." And then they showed a snippet of the horrible reaction she got when she walked out on NXT a few months ago. Even the ads for the show are completely devoid of any actual reality. At least they're consistent. It's the best thing I could say about that. Dolph Ziggler made his return, saving Lana from Rusev. He ran out to a great reaction. Unfortunately, his spray tan looked completely ridiculous. He looked like Ziggler in the front, Sheamus in the back. Seriously, from behind, if you would have given this guy a stupid haircut and a briefcase to hold, I would have been wondering, well, why is Sheamus saving Lana? I assume they're just holding off on the mixed tag match for the September pay-per-view, which is why we're getting a singles match with him and Rusev at SummerSlam. But you know, at some point, Lana and Summer Rae are getting into the ring. We had the contract signing for the match between Seth Rollins and John Cena. Rollins name-dropped Bob Dylan, who was born in Minnesota, said, "The times, they are a-changin'." The crowd did not react at all to the Bob Dylan mention. I guess if Rollins would have mentioned Demi Lovato, it would have gotten a reaction. Or Meek Mill. What the fuck is a Meek Mill anyway? Can somebody answer that for me? Oh, hey, I'm going to name myself after a quiet place that makes shit. I don't know. Fuck. Go listen to some real music, please. And I don't want to hear, oh, it was all children in the crowd. Kids don't know who Bob Dylan is. Really, I didn't know that kids drove themselves to the arena. In New York, you get your learner's permit at 16. In Minnesota, I guess the age is 6. Cena came out. He was booed. They sang John Cena Sucks. WWE finally realized what we already knew, which is that his next title is number 16. Somebody finally alerted them to this fact. And that is, of course, the Ric Flair record. They tried to explain that his new t-shirt, which references John Cena as being a 15-time world champion, was something that he came up with months ago. They kind of mentioned that as their way of trying to convince people that it's not any kind of spoiler for Sunday, which I don't think it is. But I could say this, if it took months to come up with that new t-shirt design, then I think they need some new t-shirt people. I'll put my guy in touch with them. All I know is this, Seth Rollins caved in John Cena's face with his knee, and by the next week, they were selling You Can't Knee Me t-shirts. 1 week is all it took. It doesn't take that long. Cena said that Triple H was never Ric Flair's bitch, but this Sunday he was going to make Rollins his, and with that he signed the contract. I thought this was good. Nothing out of this world. I saw people on Twitter calling it one of John Cena's best promos. I don't know what they were watching. I've seen far better from him. In fact, this was very un-Cena-like, in that he was stumbling over his words like a whole bunch of different times. He almost never does that, so I would hardly call that his best work. In a champion versus champion encounter, the NXT Women's Champion Sasha Banks beat the WWE Divas Champion Nikki Bella with the Banks statement, 10 minutes, 37 seconds. I have a few observations about this. Brie Bella was out there cheering for her sister. She did this by repeatedly chanting, "Come on, Nikki!" over and over and over and over and over again, until this red substance called blood began to leak out of my ears. Come on, Nikki! Come on, Nikki! I'm going to hear that in my fucking nightmares for the next month. The match itself, I thought, was very disappointing. I don't know who's to blame. I don't know who suggested what. But Nikki just kept grabbing a chin lock. Chin lock after chin lock. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, what are they doing? What are they doing? It's 10:40 p.m. It's the death spot on the show. These people have been sitting there for 3 hours already, if you count the pre-show tapings. Multiple rest holds? Is this part of that revolution they keep telling us about? So sure enough, the crowd gets restless. They start chanting, "We want Lesnar." which annoyed me, but I mean, really, how mad can I get about it? How mad can I be? They've been sitting there for 3 hours. They're tired. They're in Minnesota. They came to see Brock Lesnar. They've been teased all night long. They want to see Brock, and instead they're watching Nikki Bella work multiple rest holds. And maybe Sasha Banks did one or two also. But it was mostly Nikki. There were a few idiots in the crowd who tried to get a JBL chant going that got shut down real quick. That pissed me off more than the We Want Lesnar stuff. Because at least that I can understand. The JBL stuff is just them being dicks. Best parts of the match, though, were Sasha mocking Nikki with the push-ups, which I thought was great. And they actually gave us a replay of that. When was the last time you saw them show a replay of somebody doing push-ups? But, I mean, then again, they show replays of everything these days. If you fucking sneeze in the ring, we'll get a replay from five different camera angles, three of which will be in slow-mo as the snot goes flying across the ring. The other thing, which the crowd popped for, were Sasha's elevator knees in the corner. Love that move. It's a great move. People react to it all the time. I'm really happy they gave her the clean win here. This was not a total loss. This was not like a disaster or anything like that. And again, Sasha got the win, which is great. She's the one defending her championship this weekend, unlike Nikki Bella. So she should have won that match, and she did. She needs that win a lot more than Nikki does. But this was not the match I was expecting. And to be perfectly honest with you, why the fuck are they even having a champion? And this is a bigger point. I know I've talked about this before, because they used to do this shit all the time. Go back over the last 10, 12 years on Raw. How many times they did champion versus champion matches with the WWE champion and the World Heavyweight champion? Because I know they did it a whole bunch of times, and this is what I would always argue when it came to unification of those titles and why I was happy when they unified them back in 2013. Because that world title was fucking useless. At least then. Maybe now you can make the argument, well, there's guys like a Kevin Owens or a Cesaro who would benefit now from being a world champion since they're obviously not going to get the WWE title. Look, in a perfect world, if they had like a legit, genuine brand split, you could make the argument for why now it would be a good idea maybe to have a separate championship. But that was my whole argument. They didn't know how to do a brand split. They would call it a split. There was no split. They didn't know how to do it. So having two world titles when it was positioned that way was useless. You'd have the world champion, Alberto Del Rio, go out there and have a world title match on Raw at 8:27 p.m. like it was just another fucking undercard match. So here we are now. We have a champion against champion match. Now, instead of having the WWE title and the world title, it's the Divas title and the women's title. As though there is a difference between Divas and women. They both have vaginas, they both get their period, right? I don't know what the difference is between the two of them. Maybe somebody can explain that to me. Maybe one group of women are nice, the other group of women are bitches. I don't know why you would even want to call your division a bunch of bitches, because when I think diva, that's what I think. But that goes to a whole other argument about why the diva name is stupid. So here we have a champion versus champion match, right? Non-title, granted, but still, champ versus champ. That should be a big deal. 10:40 p.m. they put the match out there. They knew the match was going to die a death. They knew people were waiting for Brock to come out. They were waiting all night for this guy. I don't understand it. Why wouldn't you make a bigger deal about a match like that? That should be a big deal. Divas champ against NXT women's champ. And it just goes to show you. People will only buy into this shit as much as you give them a reason to do so. And if you don't position something as being all that big of a deal, then guess what? The people aren't going to think it's that big of a deal. And I think that had a lot... Not entirely. Again, like I said, they wanted to see Brock, but that had a lot to do with what happened here. And so the match itself was not what I was expecting it to be. I'm happy that Sasha got the win. She should have. Again, she's the one defending her championship this weekend, not Nikki. But I was expecting more, I guess, out of this match, and didn't get it. And this is not the kind of match they should be having if they're trying to get this whole Revolution stuff over. Brock Lesnar came out for his Minnesota homecoming. He was actually born in South Dakota, but he went to school in Minnesota. I know he lived there for a while. He may still live there. He may still have a home there. But last I had heard, he was living up in Canada. He looked so happy by the reaction. This really was quite the reaction. It was a sight to behold. People were going nuts for this guy. Paul Heyman topped himself yet again. He sang to Brock Lesnar to the tune of Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. The Undertaker's gong saved Heyman's life, because by the end of this promo, so there was one gong of the Undertaker's bell. Lights went out, came back on, no Undertaker. Now the Undertaker is playing mind games. Now he's just fucking with them. So Heyman went on, continued with his promo when the singing was over. He was so on with his promo that I was actually getting afraid for his life, because he looked like he was about 5 seconds away from either a heart attack or a stroke. Kind of like the way Ric Flair used to get in some of his promos in WCW, where his face would get all beet red. And they actually did an angle once where Flair pretended that he had a heart attack, one of the more tasteless things they ever did, because they didn't let anybody know about it. And I know Charles Robinson, Little Nate, who is the biggest Ric Flair fan you'll find, was like in tears backstage because he thought Ric Flair, his idol, had just had a heart attack in the ring. So yeah, nice fuck you there to WCW. But anyway, I was starting to get very worried about Heyman. And the lights went out. Undertaker saved his life. Lights came back on. There was the Undertaker. And for the second time in as many months, he kicked Brock Lesnar in his little beasts. And boy, did this crowd not like that. He chokeslammed Lesnar. He gave him a tombstone. And for the first time in a long time, the Undertaker was roundly booed. And I got to tell you, I am loving this new heelish Undertaker gimmick of showing up at random and kicking people in the balls. Seriously, if that's all that he does, if he just randomly shows up when the lights go out and kicks people in the nutsack, he could go another 5 years. Easy. I mean, here we are thinking this guy's one match away from retirement. He can get another 5 or 10 years out of his career if that's all he does. You know, Trish Stratus had the chick kick. Roderick Strong has the sick kick. Undertaker has the dick kick. Tony on Twitter pointed out that we probably shouldn't be surprised he was booed in Minneapolis, because that was the same city where some fans in the crowd gave him the what treatment during a promo that he did back in 2012. Not the promo from 2002, where the Undertaker still to this day had the best comeback to the what chance ever, when he said, say what again if you sleep with your sister? And everyone was like, what? They kind of caught themselves in mid-sentence, and Undertaker's just looking at them like, yeah, you know, that's what I thought. Still one of the best comebacks, if not the best comeback to the what chance I've ever seen. But this was the 2012 promo when he came back. It might have been before the match with like Triple H at Hell in a Cell at WrestleMania. And I went off on a rant on those idiots on the podcast. But I didn't know that, Tony. I didn't realize it was the same city. So that's an interesting little factoid there. I think what I like most about the way they've built this match up is the fact that there is no clear heel or face. You know, they've kind of positioned Undertaker as the heel, kind of. Yeah, I mean, they knew exactly what kind of reaction that low blow was going to get in Minnesota. I mean, they knew he would get booed. To them, there was no doubt about it. They had to know that. So they got the desired reaction they were looking for. But the fans are going to pick and choose who they like tomorrow night. It's New York. I think they'll both get cheered. Lesnar more so than Undertaker. I do think Undertaker is going to get some boos. Some people don't think he'll get any in New York. I disagree with that completely. But he's not going to get booed out of the building like he did in Minnesota or anything like that. I think it'll be a little more neutral than that. And we'll see what they have up their sleeve for a finish, whether or not Masked Kane does get involved, which I think he will. And if he does, how the fans react. I think the sight of Undertaker and Kane, if they are in the ring together at the end of this, you know, the Brothers of Destruction standing tall, is going to get a big pop. I think it'll get a big reaction from the crowd. But I do think Lesnar will easily be the most over guy on the show. He's the most over guy in the company. You know, John Cena is the face of the company. He's doing all the stuff that John Cena does, and the kids love him and all that. But in terms of having that one big, larger-than-life superstar that just will get massive reactions wherever he goes, Brock is the guy. He's the only guy. Cena may be, you know, close number two. But, of course, he still gets his mixed reactions. Nobody gets a reaction like Brock Lesnar does, because he's an attraction. He's special. He's not there every week. And people look at him as the real deal. They don't look at him as a poser. He's not fake or phony or anything like that. He can kick your ass. You can believe that this guy in real life, outside of the ring, would kill you and would take your arm and, you know, attach it to your nose and take your foot and shove it up your ass and God knows what else. So I'm very fascinated. I'm looking forward to seeing forget the match. I don't know how good the match itself will be, but just the crowd reaction to both guys. I'm more kind of excited than anything else to see how that plays out. But I have become a fan of the way they've booked this. I'm into it, you know. And again, there's no clear cut heel or babyface, even though Undertaker is doing heelish stuff like kicking people in the crotch, which is not something that Undertaker has done before. I've had some people email me and say, "Well, what's so heelish about him? He hasn't really done anything heelish, you know. He's done that before." I don't remember him really doing that before. Even when he was Big Evil and he was clearly a heel in WWE in 2003, the thing about The Undertaker was he always looked you in the eye, put his fists up. I mean, sometimes maybe he would run away, you know, when he was the heel. He would back down from a fight every now and again. But when he was face-to-face with somebody, he'd put his fists up and he'd go toe-to-toe. He wouldn't just go around kicking people in the nutsack. You know, so it's just not something you would expect The Undertaker to do. I'm sure he'll probably go for another nut shot tomorrow night. I would think that Brock will be prepared for it this time. I would pop huge if he kicked Brock in the crotch and then Brock like reached into his shorts and pulled out a cup and like hit him in the head with it or something. But I think Lesnar will be prepared this time.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week had the contract signing between Bayley and Sasha Banks for their Women's Championship match at TakeOver. I thought Sasha did a hell of a job with her end of it, and Bayley did too, but Sasha had more time to really cut that promo that just made you want to see Bayley beat her in the worst way. They've really built Bayley up as this sympathetic character that just, she has to win the championship at this show, and I think she will. After the fact, she actually went after Sasha in the aisleway when Sasha went to leave and attacked her. Bayley snapped, and she was just going after her, beating the crap out of her, had to be pulled off by officials. It was a side of Bayley we've never seen before, so I thought this was well done. Samoa Joe beat some random dude, 30 seconds, got blindsided. See, I can't recover from a flub quite as good as Kevin Owens did that one time against Hideo Itami. So we just have to move on and pretend that never happened. Samoa Joe got blindsided, there you go, by Baron Corbin, who beat his ass all over the arena and then laid him out with the End of Days. And speaking of great Kevin Owens promos, we got one here on this show. Maybe my favorite one that I've heard him cut yet on WWE television. He came out with a ladder that he set up in the middle of the ring, and he started cutting a promo on Finn Balor. He's talking about TakeOver. There were some fans in the crowd who booed at the first mention of Brooklyn, because that's what these Florida fans at Full Sail have been doing for weeks now, like a bunch of spoiled, entitled little brats ever since they found out that they weren't getting TakeOver. And Kevin Owens stopped and he pointed to the people in the crowd and he said that that's exactly what's wrong with, you know, wrestling. He called them the John Cena of fans. Because there's nothing real and genuine that ever comes out of their mouths. I mean, this whole rant was just awesome. And he talked about how they boo because they're spoiled and entitled. We're not getting TakeOver. Brooklyn's going to get it. And they're like a toy that has been taken away from them. And they pretend like they care about the NXT superstars and the NXT brand and they want to see it grow. But in reality, they're just selfish and they only want things for themselves. And when they don't get it, they boo. And he said, you know, NXT went to Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. They sold out 13,000 strong. The brand is getting bigger. It's getting healthier and better and expanding. And you people, basically you people don't give a shit. That's effectively what he said. And it was just awesome. Because everything he said was true, right? The fans are very fickle. Not just at NXT, even in WWE. They'll cheer for you one week. They'll boo you the next week. They don't know what they want. The people don't know what they want. But they say, oh, NXT, we love NXT, and they chant the NXT initials, and then NXT goes to Brooklyn. This is going to be their biggest show ever. And at the first mention of Brooklyn, they boo. Every week, loudly and passionately, they boo. And I'm sure on some level, Kevin Owens probably believes that. Even though he incorporated it into his promo, there's an element of truth there. And that is what makes a great promo. Look at some of the greatest promos that WWE has ever had. Look at the CM Punk pipe bomb promo. You don't think that CM Punk believed everything that he said? Or 90% of what came out of his mouth? That was the whole genesis of the promo. He was leaving. He was frustrated. He didn't care. Everything he said had an element of truth to it. And you felt that and you believed it because of the conviction and the passion in his voice and the look on his face. He was turning red. I mean, that's why that promo was so effective. Bret Hart, when Bret Hart turned heel after WrestleMania, and he did that promo where he said American wrestling fans coast to coast can kiss his ass, right? Some of the stuff he said in that promo, I'm sure, there was an element of truth there. He probably honestly felt that way. Talking about how, you know, in Canada, he had these other promos where he would say, in Canada, we don't go shooting each other up on every street corner. And that was in 1997. That was before Columbine and before all these movie theater shootings and senseless school shootings and things that we've had here in this country ever since then, which you don't really hear about in other parts of the world. I mean, there's other bad things that happen in other countries and other parts of the world. But as far as school shootings and massacres and shit, that only seems to happen in this country. I wonder why. But, you know, Bret would talk about stuff like that even then in his promos, and we take care of our sick and we don't leave them to fend for themselves. I mean, he was incorporating real life into his promos. And you could think of a gazillion other examples of it. That's just two of them that I came up with off the top of my head. Maybe The Rock, when he first turned heel and joined The Nation, and he talked about the die Rocky die and the Rocky sucks chance. I mean, he was taking that anger from within him and it was manifesting itself on television, and he was using it to make his character that much stronger. So Kevin Owens going out there and saying all this stuff, I could believe him because I honestly think that he believes everything that he said at the beginning of that promo there when he was talking about the fans and how they don't care and they're not genuine. And then, of course, he very slickly turned it around into, you know, a classic wrestling promo talking about Finn Balor and why he's going to lose and why Kevin Owens is going to win. I just thought this thing was a fucking work of art. If you didn't see it, you have to go out of your way to watch it. Go on the network. You know, people ripped it. They put it on YouTube as well. However you find it, just watch this promo, especially the first half, because it's awesome. And I thought he did a tremendous job of selling that match. I was already sold. I mean, you give Kevin Owens and Finn Balor a ladder and you put him in the ring in Brooklyn, I'm sold. You don't really have to do much more than that to get me convinced. But if there was any convincing left to be done, I think Kevin Owens did it all on his own, to the point where I agree with some of you guys who wrote into me. I almost wanted to see the guy win. I still think he's losing. I think it would be a very confusing decision to take the belt off Finn Balor in his first title defense. But I was left thinking to myself, you know what? This guy has a point. I'd like to see this guy win the championship just to shove it in people's faces. So if you didn't see it, go out of your way to see it. Finn Balor did come out. The lights went out. He's like the Undertaker of NXT. And when they came back on, he was standing on the top rope, eyeballing Kevin Owens. They ended up brawling. Kevin Owens got away. Finn Balor got on the mic, said he was going to kick Kevin Owens' ass at TakeOver. I thought this was a fine finishing segment to what had otherwise been a pretty ho-hum, dull version of NXT. Perfectly fine, I guess, to help get certain guys over before TakeOver. You know, Tyler Breeze had a squash and had a Jushin Thunder Liger mask and put it on his opponent's head at the end of the match. You know, it wasn't like a bad show. It was pretty dull because nothing happened until Kevin Owens came out. Ring of Honor. I did catch Ring of Honor again this week. I actually caught it last night. Just to run through this really quickly here. Dalton Castle and Silas Young continued their feud. They had a pretty good match on this show. And Dalton Castle got the win with the aid of a distraction by Dalton's boys at ringside, the Tate Twins. After the match, Silas gets on the mic as Castle's about to leave with his boys. He tells Castle, "I don't like what you do with your boys." I thought to myself, I don't like where this is going. This sounds very weird. And then he said that he doesn't approve of Dalton's lifestyle and that his boys need to learn to be real men. So he challenged Dalton Castle to one more match. And if he wins, he being Silas Young, he gets Dalton Castle's boys so he can teach them how to be real men. I can totally believe that the Silas Young character would not approve of anything that Dalton Castle does, the way he looks, the way he walks, the way he talks. anything he may be doing with his boys. Totally believe that. The Silas Young character, he's got that thing down pat. But him saying, if I beat you, I get your boys, just sounded hilariously wrong to me. Moose. Pin Will Ferrara. You thought I was doing the Moose chant there. I pumped my fist when I said that. Moose! Pin Will Ferrara with a spear in a match that was actually more competitive than it had any right to be, but Moose did get the win in the end. Main event was Roppongi Vice against the Young Bucks. Man, these Young Bucks are everywhere. They were showered in streamers before the match. They were beloved by the crowd there in Baltimore. They had a long match. Young Bucks did get the win with more bang for your buck. That's when the Addiction with Chris Sabin. So Daniels, Kazarian, and Sabin came out. They laid waste to the Young Bucks. They tied, I think it was Matt, up to the top rope using tape. So he was defenseless as they beat the shit out of him. They beat the shit out of his brother. They actually used the their own Indie Taker move, which is basically a spike tombstone pile driver off the top rope on Nick. Laid him out. And that was how they went off the air, with the Young Bucks laid to waste. Let's get to your mailbag questions here. If you have questions, you could always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. And the first question here I want to get to is actually something that was tweeted to me right before I started recording the show. So I knew nothing about this until Kelvin brought it to my attention. He wanted to know my thoughts on Greg Valentine's comments on women and women's wrestling. Now, I had not heard Greg Valentine's comments, so I looked it up, and I have it here on my phone in front of me. Apparently, Greg Valentine was on a podcast called The View Podcast. It's a pro wrestling podcast of some kind, and he, I don't know how it came up, but he gave his thoughts on women's wrestling. Now, why you would ask Greg Valentine about women's wrestling, I have no idea. But I guess he must have been asked about it, or it came up. This is what he said his thoughts were on, actually, what he calls girl wrestling. It's not women's wrestling, it's girl wrestling. He says, as far as girl wrestling, I would send them all out to the strip bar and fire them. I'd fire every girl wrestler I ever saw. They don't draw any money. They have horrible matches. They're terrible. That's the way I feel. And later on, it actually got worse. He was talking about women and how he loves women, but this is Greg Valentine's view on women in general in society. He said, they take away jobs from men that need to support their families. They should be home washing dishes and cooking and pregnant and barefoot. I love women, but they got to realize their place. They're not supposed to be wrestlers. They're not supposed to be MMA fighters or boxers. It's bullshit. So, not mincing any words there. That's how Greg Valentine feels about women and women's wrestling, or girl wrestling as he calls it. And all I can say, my only reaction to that is, I don't really give a shit what Greg Valentine thinks about women. His views on women's wrestling, it's completely irrelevant to me. And I don't know why anybody would put much stock in what this lesbian drag queen has to say. Because that's exactly what Greg Valentine looks like these days. Have you seen Greg Valentine? Because that's exactly what I said 2 months ago when I did my review of that show at Citi Field. Greg Valentine was on that show, and I think I made the same comment then. He looks like a fucking lesbian in drag. In fact, if I didn't know any better, I would think that Greg Valentine maybe was trying to get an angle going so that he could wrestle for the Divas Championship in WWE. He'd fit right in. Cameron, from London, England. During Kevin Owens' entrance on Raw, a kid by the ramp had a sign that read, Fat Owens Fat. I'm not sure if you picked up on this, but I sure did. It just pissed me off to see a sign like that. It's a sign of bullying, which I don't like, yet WWE is all about don't be a bully, be a star. I'm sure Kevin Owens probably wasn't bothered by this, but it may have hit him in some form. After all, he is human. To allow your kid to make that sign, and for WWE to allow a sign like that to be on the show, just bothered me. I wanted to get your thoughts on this. It's not a big deal. I mean, the bigger deal, I guess, is that you saw it because the camera focused on it. So what does that tell you? There's been a lot of talk about Kevin Owens and forces that like him, forces that don't, Kevin Dunn and this and that. And I said last week I was not defending Kevin Dunn. Kevin Dunn didn't have anything to do with Randy Orton making that comment a few weeks ago, even though people kind of jumped to the conclusion that he did. But Kevin Owens, or Kevin Dunn, rather, I got my Kevins mixed up there. He is the head of production. He does run the show. And so any kind of lingering shot on a sign that says Fat Owens Fat comes from the top. But as far as the sign itself, look, I've seen far worse. I don't see what the big deal is here. I mean, how PC are we going to get here? You know what I mean? You know, should it say Heavy Owens Heavy? I mean, yeah, the kid was poking fun at his physical appearance, but it's wrestling. There is a line that you don't cross. You know, you're not going to show a sign on TV that says, you know, you fat fuck, or use other like racial slurs and stuff like that. But you know, a sign that says Fat Owens Fat, I just don't. What's the big deal? It's bullying now? Wrestling is bullying. Any wrestler that comes out and cuts a promo on the other guy and says, I'm going to kick your ass, guess what? He's bullying him. Should they not do that? At SummerSlam, I'm going to kick your ass. Oh, be a star. I mean, where do you draw the line? It's going to take a lot more than that to offend me. I wasn't bothered by the sign itself. If anything, I was more bothered by the fact that they spent as much time showing it on TV as they did, because I think that probably speaks to their mindset. LeBrian from El Paso, Texas, with ratings down in WWE, why haven't they brought back Bill Goldberg? I'm pretty sure with Goldberg, their business would be up at least a little bit. Well, it's not that Goldberg doesn't want to do it. Goldberg has said time after time that he would love to have one more match, one more program, one more, you know, WrestleMania match in WWE. And it's WWE that doesn't want him. And when I say WWE, I'm really talking Triple H. Triple H has had at least one conversation with Bill Goldberg, according to Goldberg, and you know, they were cordial to each other, but Triple H does not like Bill Goldberg. It was Triple H and Shawn Michaels who actually spoke up against his induction into the Hall of Fame back when they had WrestleMania in Atlanta. I want to say that was like 2011. Goldberg probably would have gone in that year. I mean, Goldberg reached his pinnacle of success working for the Atlanta-based WCW. They probably would have headlined with him or had him as one of the headline. I think Shawn Michaels was the headline that year. Maybe that's why. Maybe Shawn didn't want to be trumped by Goldberg. He didn't want to share the spotlight with Goldberg. But they didn't want him in, so he didn't go in. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't put him in some other city some other year. I think one day Goldberg is going to get in just by virtue of them running out of big names to put in there. He'll go in at some point. But Triple H does not like Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg does not like Triple H. And that creates a very big problem. Now, I think you're absolutely right. I think if they brought Goldberg back for the right match, they could do pretty big business. Does that mean Raw ratings are going to shoot up by 0.5, you know, ratings points? I don't know that he's that big of a ratings mover. But I know that when they had that Goldberg DVD last year that they put out, that was the highest selling DVD they had. I remember reading they were pretty surprised by that, by how many DVDs of his they sold, considering he hasn't been on television for any promotion, not just their own, in over a decade. 2004 would have been the last time we saw him. And they put a Goldberg DVD out and it sold like hotcakes. So I don't have any doubt that he would be good for business. And it's not that Goldberg is completely against the idea. He's actually in favor of it. He would love to have his son watch him live at least once in a match. WWE doesn't want it. Matt from Florida. Jerry Lawler stated on the air that Christian was retired, but supposedly Christian later said in an interview that he was not retired. I know reports say the WWE stopped using him due to the number of concussions he's had, but Christian seemed to think that he was ready to come back. Even if Christian cannot compete in WWE anymore, why wouldn't they at least give him some sort of proper send-off? I know he wasn't the biggest name in the company, but the guy had a nice run in the last 4 or 5 years of his career. I think he is one of the only wrestlers that went to TNA after having success in WWE, only to come back and have even more success as a singles performer in WWE than he did the first time around. His time in TNA actually helped him become a main event level talent in WWE. Feels like they basically are making the decision for him by stating that he was retired on the air. It probably blindsided him. Christian deserved better than what he got. He got dealt a bad hand. I see a lot of similarities between the Christian situation and the Daniel Bryan situation. I think what happened with Christian is that he was getting hurt a lot, mostly concussions, and they decided we're not going to clear this guy, and that's the same thing that's happening right now with Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan says he's ready to come back. You know, he's been cleared independently by a doctor, at least one, but the WWE medical staff will not clear him. You know, and Bryan has a history of concussions, just like Christian does. Bryan suffered another concussion this year, and the company just is very, very hesitant to clear him. If they think this guy may be a liability for them, then they're well within their rights to make that call and not give him the medical clearance that he wants. But I agree. I mean, it sounded to me like what happened is Christian and WWE were not exactly on the same page when they went and said that he was retired. I think it probably was news to him. I think it did blindside him. He seems to have a very different view on that, or at least he did at the time. And the way that he has just sort of faded into the background, he has no role on TV, they never mention him, I think it's sad. I think it's kind of sad, because I think he can bring a lot to the table, even as like a coach or a trainer at NXT, or in some other capacity, if he wants to. Maybe he doesn't want to do that, but if he wants to have a role in the company, there's a lot of different things he could do. He's a good talker. Try him out as an announcer. I don't know, but they never mention him, and they're obviously not going to clear him. In their mind, he's done, and he's just kind of faded into obscurity, and I think that's really sad, because I think he deserves better than that. I don't think you're ever going to see them give Christian a balloon and ticker tape celebration like they would if, when Shawn Michaels retired, or one of those really, really big names. But he was still a big name. He was a world champion. He is one of the few names left that they have under contract, you know, from the Attitude Era, kind of a relic, I guess, in a way, of the Attitude Era that everybody loves to talk about. And it's just very sad. Jesse from Jamaica, Queens. In your buy or sell of Shawn Michaels, you mentioned that you can predate the Attitude Era to the fall of 1996. What do you consider to be the earliest sign of the Attitude Era, and what are some notable moments that just kept sort of hinting at it? Well, when I think of that first moment that, again, I don't think it started the Attitude Era. I think it really began to form in the fall of 96 with those four guys, Bret, Shawn, Sid, Undertaker, and just everybody being pissed off at everybody for whatever reason. That was the real start. And then when Bret had that meltdown and that cursing tirade on Raw in 97, that was the first kind of shot that was fired in the Attitude Era. But as far as the first moment, I think back to the promo that Kevin Nash cut as Diesel the night after Survivor Series in 95 when he lost the championship and he beat the crap out of Bret and powerbombed him and turned heel, basically, and left him laying. And he came out on Raw the next night. He didn't even stand in the ring. He kind of walked over to where the announcers were. He was like looking at Vince. Yeah, and this was a time when people really weren't talking about Vince McMahon, the owner of the company. He was still Vince the announcer. And they were starting to blur those lines, and Diesel just grabbed a mic, and he said, you know, Big Daddy Cool is back. Almost like the company was kind of making him somebody that he wasn't for the last year as champion, and now he's back. And if you're with me, you'll wear a black glove, and I'll smack your hand every time. But if you don't, then you're not with me, and get out of my way. It was very, very interesting, because you didn't see that sort of thing in WWE back then. They didn't blur the lines. There were no real tweeners. You were either a heel or a babyface. You were a good guy or a bad guy. And Diesel was in between. He was doing that before Steve Austin was. And then he had a match with Owen Hart the next month. Remember, Shawn, you know, had the whole concussion storyline. And, I mean, Shawn Michaels, who was the top babyface, I guess along with Bret, was still best friends with Diesel when Diesel did this. And Diesel said, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to wrestle Owen. I'm doing this for you, Shawn. And he powerbombed him. He went to give him another powerbomb and shoved the referee down when the ref tried to stop him. So he got DQ'd. You know, he was doing that sort of thing. And then the stuff with Undertaker, where he felt cheated out of the fact that Undertaker was getting a title shot at the Royal Rumble and not him. And Diesel went into that Royal Rumble, lost to Shawn Michaels, actually, and kind of teased beating Shawn up from behind, if you remember, when that Rumble was over, but he didn't do it. They kind of sort of hinted at it. But then when Bret and Undertaker had the championship match at that Rumble show in 96, it was Diesel who interfered and cost Undertaker the match, and then that famous scene of Diesel standing in the aisleway flipping the middle finger at The Undertaker. And you did not see that in wrestling either of the mainstream shows, like WCW or WWE, you didn't see that at all. That was the first time anybody did anything like that on TV. Him flipping the bird to The Undertaker was one of those, like, wow moments. Like, when I was younger, I actually rewound it. Like, wow, did that just happen? That was a big deal. And that was a simple middle finger. I mean, that became commonplace in the Attitude Era. But it was a big deal when he did that. So Diesel, at the end of 95, beginning of 96, that was the first... Those are the first hints of what was to come. Both the middle finger and just the way that that whole character was portrayed as shades of gray and not being one or the other. That became the norm later on, but that was the first real hint of it. And I'll throw this in there too. Ultimate Warrior came back at WrestleMania in 1996, and the first feud that he had coming out of Mania was with Goldust. Now, Goldust was still in the early throes of his character. He was the Intercontinental Champion. He was doing the overtly, you know, kind of gay character. They wanted you to think he was gay, but he wasn't. He was just playing, you know, head games with people. And it's funny, too, because we would learn much later on what Ultimate Warrior's views were on homosexuality and that sort of stuff. This was in 1996 before we really knew about any of that. And Ultimate Warrior did a promo on Raw with Vince McMahon. It may have been his first promo since he came back. And he looked like the Ultimate Warrior of old. He looked more like the Ultimate Warrior of old in 96 than he did when he came back in 92. When he came back in 92, it looked like somebody had taken the Ultimate Warrior and threw him in the dryer. I mean, he lost so much mass and so much size, and I'll let you figure out why. Maybe it was so bad that people, that's where the rumors come from, that people thought the Ultimate Warrior, the original one, was dead. He died in a car crash, and this was somebody else. No, it was the same person, just a lot smaller. Now, as 92 went on, he started wearing a singlet for the first time in his career that I can remember. He was wearing like this muscular, flesh-colored singlet, and he did get bigger as 92 went on, to the point where in November he got fired because they were cracking down on drug stuff, and that's why he got bigger as the year went on. Anyway, I don't know why I mentioned that, but in 96 he came back. It was the Ultimate Warrior of old. He was big. He was muscular. The people were into him. And now he's in the ring with Goldust. And the first thing that I remember him saying to Goldust, it was very un-warrior-like. First of all, he was coherent. This was not the Ultimate Warrior of old in terms of promos. Those maniacal, gibberish nonsense promos in the late 80s, early 90s that you remember him doing. He was actually coherent. He was speaking English. You can understand what he was saying. He was speaking clearly and with a lot of anger and conviction in his voice. It was a lot like the Ultimate Warrior that you would see doing a speech on a college campus 10 years later. It was a lot closer to that warrior than the warrior of 1990. And the first thing I remember him telling Goldust, when Goldust was in the ring with him, coming on to him, he said, "Whatever it is that you're into, I don't give a shit." Which they bleeped. And again, that's not something that you would see on Raw. Somebody dropping an S-bomb. Let alone the Ultimate Warrior. That'd be like Hulk Hogan going out there and saying, "Hey, Goldust, fuck you, brother." It's not something that you would see. So he said that to Goldust. And then that was actually a great promo because I remember the last line. It was so great. Goldust at the time was the big movie buff and he would do movie quotes. And he may have made a comment to the Warrior, but I want to take you on like an action adventure or something like that. And the Warrior ended the promo by telling him, he goes, he said, you know, if you're looking for a full-length action-packed adventure, I got a full-length movie for you, me kicking your ass from beginning to end. And then like, wham, he just clotheslined him and the place went nuts. It was actually a great line, but it was so un-Warrior-like, just him, A, being understandable, and B, you know, cussing up a storm. Those were the earliest examples, at least in WWE, that I could point to of the so-called Attitude Era. And it, of all people, it came from Kevin Nash and the Ultimate Warrior. Not the two people I would have expected. So, yeah, those are the hints I could think of. Aside from that, it was pretty much status quo. I mean, there really wasn't anything else going on that I could point to that, you know, you could say, oh, that was the earliest sign of it. I think that Diesel promo, I think the middle finger, and I think that Warrior promo, which all came within a few months of each other, those would have been the earliest examples. Ben from Charlotte, why do you think Steve Williams, Dr. Death, Never won a major singles championship in either WCW or WWE. I've watched a few of his matches on YouTube lately and forgot how great and believable he was in the ring. His stint in WCW with Gordy back in 92 was great. Any thoughts on this? Was he difficult to work with? I can't speak for WCW because I don't know what the deal was there. I guess he was just slotted at a certain level. I know he also worked in Japan, so I don't know if that was more a matter of... If he was still doing Japan tours at that time, maybe he wasn't fully committed to WCW, and so they didn't want to put the championship on him, and maybe they just didn't think he was as marketable, which he wasn't as marketable as a guy like Sting. Vader was also on top in 92. You have to remember that. And Vader was fucking awesome. In 1991, 1992, Vader was the ultimate super heavyweight. He was a bigger guy than Dr. Death was. He was doing moonsaults off the top rope. You talk about a believable style. Yeah, I mean, Dr. Death may have been believable, but there was nobody more believable as a monster in WCW at that time than Vader. So maybe Vader had a little bit to do with that, too, because if he wasn't around, who knows? Maybe they would have booked Dr. Death against Sting. But they went with Vader. They didn't really need to put the championship on a guy like Steve Williams. But I wonder how much the Japanese stuff, if he still had Japanese commitments, then they absolutely would not put the championship on him. Maybe that had something to do with it. In WWE, it's very simple, because JR helped broker the deal. You know, he was Jim Ross's boy. The idea was, put him in the Brawl for All in 98, that Brawl for All tournament. He's going to win the Brawl for All, and you'll have a ready-made challenger set up for the other Steve Williams, Steve Austin. And he was going to feud with Austin for the WWF Championship. That was the idea. Would he have won the championship? I don't know. We'll never know. We'll never know the answer to that, if they would have actually put the title on him. But that was the idea, that he would be built up in this Brawl for All as this wrecking machine, as this realistic ass-kicker, and would then challenge Austin for the title on top. Unfortunately for them, Bart Gunn didn't get the memo, and he knocked the shit out of Dr. Death. Now, you know, Williams had torn his hamstring, I think, in that same fight. He was already hobbled. He was hurt when he got knocked the hell out by Bart Gunn. He may have been knocked out anyway, regardless of whether or not he tore his hamstring. We'll never know. Once that happened, that killed it dead. And they kept him around, I think, for a little bit after that, but they never really used him. They never really did much with him. That killed whatever run he may have had for himself in WWE. So as far as that company goes, that's the reason why. The Brawl for All. That killed any potential title run for Dr. Death. Ross from Edmonton, Alberta. I know that Edge got injured in the summer of 2007 and had to vacate the World Heavyweight title. Do you have any idea why they put the title on the Great Khali? And if you could pick one person, anyone else at the time on the roster to put the championship on, who would it have been? I could think of about, I don't know, 7 feet, 4 inches worth of reasons why Vince McMahon put the title on him. I mean, what do you think? I don't have the 2007 roster in front of me, so I'm just going based off memory here, but I know Bobby Lashley was one of their pet projects at the time. Bobby Lashley, I know, around that same time, was challenging John Cena for the championship. I remember him and Cena, I think, headlining a pay-per-view for the title after the Benoit stuff. I think it was the very next show they had. So it was around the same time. He lost. Cena beat him, as Cena did with everybody at that time. But I'd have maybe put it on Lashley, the world title. I wouldn't have even feuded him with Cena. I mean, you can't tell me that Bobby Lashley, as green as he was then, would not have been able to carry on better matches and better promos than the Great Khali. Why, other than his size, would they have put the championship on Khali? He couldn't talk, couldn't work. They put it on him because he was big. He's a freak. And they like that freak show appeal. So you put the title on the big guy. There was nothing else that he brought to the table that somebody like Lashley, even back then, couldn't have done better. And Lashley himself, look, Lashley was no slouch. Lashley's the kind of guy who you see him at an airport. I mean, yeah, you're going to see Khali first, but you would turn and say, whoa, look at that guy. You know, he was big and jacked and in great shape. He was a big guy. He wasn't a cruiserweight. He wasn't a small guy that Vince, hates or something like that. So I would have put it on Lashley. Lashley would have been the guy. I mean, Lashley was by no means a great promo himself, but, you know, Lashley the Destroyer, like he was in TNA, if you wanted to go the heel route with him. as the world champion that summer. I think that would have worked a hell of a lot better than Kali. It's very weird to me how they chose Bobby Lashley for such a high-profile spot that same year on the WrestleMania card. He was Donald Trump's representative, potentially the next U.S. president, Donald Trump. I don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, he is running for president. But he was Donald Trump's representative in the hair versus hair match with Vince McMahon. Remember Bobby Lindsay, my guy, Bobby Lindsay. I'm like, who the fuck is Bobby Lindsay? It was Bobby Lashley. And after that was over, they didn't do anything with him. They didn't do much of anything with Bobby Lashley after that match. He was never in as high profile a match as the one he had at WrestleMania. That was like the pinnacle for him. They put the ECW title on him, but so what? They put the ECW title on Matt Hardy and Christian. Two guys they didn't exactly slot in a high position on the roster at that time. They said, oh, these guys can work. They can work with the younger guys. Perfect. We'll make them the ECW champion. It's not like being the ECW champion was viewed as some major accomplishment back then. I think they put the ECW title on Ezekiel Jackson, too. It's like, so what? And it always confused me why, if they would consider him for such a high-profile spot at WrestleMania, you know, the biggest WrestleMania match, as it turned out, of all time, at least at that time. I don't know if Rock and Cena may have eclipsed it, but to look at the way that they used him after the fact, I mean, it was just like, wow. You know, you would think they had big plans for this guy, and then you look at what they did, and it's like, well, I guess they didn't have big plans for this guy. And then whatever happened with him and Michael Hayes, and he left, and that whole thing, but it's just very confusing. Paolo. Is it Paolo or Paolo? I'm going to say Paolo, because that sounds cooler. From West Hazleton, Pennsylvania. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. Which was the better system, OVW Developmental or FCW/NXT Developmental? Well, I mean, I'd have to say OVW until I see evidence to the contrary. I think the jury is still out on NXT. I mean, NXT as a brand right now is hot, but it's hot because of all the indie guys they brought in, right? Finn Balor, Hideo Itami, Sami Zayn, Samoa Joe. Those are not guys that you would consider developmental, like homegrown developmental guys who are just learning as they come up through the system, like John Cena did in OVW and Brock Lesnar did coming out of college and going to OVW, Shelton Benjamin, Randy Orton. I mean, there were a lot of other guys, those are like the highest profile guys. Batista came through OVW as well. And then they had other guys like Nick Dinsmore and the Basham brothers, who I know were only mid-card acts on the main roster, but they were still, you know, talented guys who came up through that system. And there were a few other names I'm not even remembering right now. I look at NXT, it doesn't really have a great track record. FCW and NXT don't have a great track record of taking homegrown guys from scratch and turning them into big-time stars. Seth Rollins is the world champion right now, and he came up through FCW and maybe the very beginnings of NXT, but he also was a guy with experience that they plucked from the indies. And really, he had no business even being in developmental as long as he was. So you can't really use Seth Rollins as an example. Roman Reigns? Yeah, you could probably say Roman Reigns is one example. You know, when he came in, he was, you know, Leaki, and he was dressed differently, and then they turned him heel, and he was doing this gimmick where he wore fancy suits and Rolex watches. Then they came up with the Shield idea, and they've turned him into a big star. I still think Roman Reigns is going to end up being the next, you know, big babyface to take over whenever John Cena is, you know, finally toning it down. I don't think they've given up on Roman Reigns just yet. So he may end up being the biggest example, the biggest success story to come out of that system, but I can't think of hardly anybody else. Because, again, Rollins and Ambrose and Sami Zayn and Samoa Joe and Kevin Owens, these are guys that already had a lot of success. They could already work. They were already making a name for themselves elsewhere, and they brought them in. You can't credit the NXT developmental system for them being a big success. You can't do that. So I think the jury is still very much out on NXT. So I'm going to go with OVW for now. I think OVW was a bigger success in terms of grooming and creating homegrown talent. Samarth says, if you had the chance, which would you change? The summer of Punk 2011 not getting squashed by Triple H and Kevin Nash and getting booked properly, or The Undertaker's undefeated streak remaining intact. I've made no bones about the fact that I was not a fan of them ending The Undertaker's streak at WrestleMania. And if it were up to me, I wouldn't have done it. That being said, if I could change one thing, I would change their booking of Punk in 2011. I think that did far more damage. You could actually argue that breaking The Undertaker's streak was a benefit to them business-wise, because it allowed them to create this unstoppable monster for, you know, Brock Lesnar's character, who at the time, Brock had already been beaten by John Cena. He had a feud with Triple H that was very dull. He lost to Triple H at WrestleMania, which, again, should never have happened. But it's Triple H, so what do you expect? He needed some rehabbing himself, because they weren't doing what they really should have been doing with Brock at the time. But ever since he beat The Undertaker, I have to say, they got it right. He was on a fucking unstoppable tear. The way he beat Cena at SummerSlam, which would have been Bryan, if Bryan wasn't hurt, he would have been the one getting his ass kicked, 16 German suplexes. It turned out to be John Cena, which was even better, because nobody expected John Cena to get manhandled that way. And it was a big boon for the Brock Lesnar character that he was able to do that to the biggest star in the company. And he just went on this tear, and him and Heyman, I mean, they're the best thing going right now in WWE. Maybe that doesn't happen if they don't put him over Undertaker in that WrestleMania match. You know, all of that has led to where we are now. It's led to where we are this weekend, going into this rematch, right, at SummerSlam. Without that story, we wouldn't have this match right now. So you could argue that there were some really good positive things that came out of that, even if you're sad that the streak is over. You know, it's not like WrestleMania is going to do bad business. WrestleMania did just fine this year, and this was the first Undertaker match since he lost. So WrestleMania is going to do just fine. WWE is going to do just fine. Brock Lesnar is doing great. But I look at the Summer of Punk that year and what they did with him. It still annoys me that, you know, Kevin Nash powerbombed him on TV 3 times and never got his comeuppance, and Triple H had to beat him in that one match, and they never did have a rematch after that. I was like Triple H's way of saying, oh, yeah, this guy actually is good. He passed the test. As though, you know, I'm not going to get into this again. But the other thing that I would offer, and I know I've pitched this idea before, and I don't like talking about John Cena turning heel. I get questions every fucking week about John Cena turning heel, and if it happened, and is this the right time? Maybe now it's going to happen. Like, just stop. Just stop. But every now and then, I will kind of go back in the time machine and talk about, like in this case, 2011, and what they could have done in terms of potentially turning John Cena back then. Like, we know WWE actually considered turning him in 2012, because Cena has said that himself. There were discussions. They never got to the very, very serious stage, but there were discussions of turning him in that Rock feud, or maybe even after the match with Rock. And Cena went out, he had new theme music made, he was getting new gear, and then it ended up being for nothing because there was no way they were going to turn him. So it's not like they wouldn't consider it. They did consider it a few months later. What if they handled the Punk stuff correctly, kept him out a little bit longer than they did, which was what, 2 weeks? Let him go all over the place with that title. Let him work some indie shows. He doesn't have to work a TNA show. Let him work some indie shows, or even an ROH show back then. Or fly him to Japan and let him do a Japan show and take the championship with him. Not defend it, but, you know, he could take it around with him, get people talking. I loved it when he crashed the Comic-Con panel. I mean, they were doing it right for a little bit. But then it's like, oh, we got to get him back. We got to get him back. We have to put him in the main event of SummerSlam. We got to do the rematch. And so they rushed him back. That was the first thing they did that took the edge off that whole storyline. The Triple H and Kevin Nash stuff is what, you know, that came later on. And then they ended up putting the championship on him at Survivor Series. He beat Del Rio in what was not the main event. That became a pattern for CM Punk as the champion, right? He would wrestle, he would defend the title on all these pay-per-views. He would never be in the main event. It was still John Cena in all the main events. So yeah, he was the champion. He got a 434-day reign, more than half of which was spent in semi-main events. So what if they would have kept Punk out for a period of a few months as opposed to a week or two, and really built a storyline around him coming back, having a match with John Cena, who was standing up for the company, right? I'm Mr. WWE, and what you did is not right. And then they have a match. They do the turn. Cena goes corporate because he represents everything that Vince McMahon wants in a champion. Punk is the polar opposite. Now Cena finally has done the turn, and Punk is now in the position, he's in the driver's seat as the clear top babyface in the company. Because Punk, I mean, he was massively over that summer. They had something in him if they wanted to pull the trigger and make him the top guy, and they didn't do it. But what if they did? And they used that to turn Cena because now they have somebody. Now they have somebody that's massively over who sells a bunch of merchandise, right? It doesn't make sense to turn John Cena unless you have somebody who's already ready to step in his shoes and be the next John Cena. That's why Roman Reigns, he's not ready. Because Roman Reigns is not selling the way that Cena does. He's not drawing the crowds the way that Cena does. They've done a poor job of getting that person ready to be the next John Cena. You can't just say, okay, John Cena, you're done. We're going to pick this guy to be the new number one guy. And this new number one guy has no proven track record of being able to sell anything. Oh, well, he'll grow into it. No, they're not in a position to wait for somebody to grow into it. You either have somebody who's ready or not. And that's why John Cena's in the spot that he's in, because nobody's ready. They've done a poor job of getting somebody ready to step in his shoes and not have business go down. But I really think in that summer of 2011, they had that person in Punk. And they had this great storyline that people were, they were creaming their pants. Oh my God, CM Punk, he put the belt in his refrigerator. Like it was the greatest thing ever. Oh my God, CM Punk crashed the Comic-Con panel. And he told Triple H, hey, you know, Stephanie's got my number. Tell her to give me a call. Like, they were going in the right direction. But they just couldn't help themselves. And they just took the edge off way too soon. And I really think if they would have played their cards right, they could have had this new guy, this new top guy in WWE, and now he's got a heel John Cena for him to feud with. They could have gotten a whole bunch of pay-per-view, of new pay-per-view matches out of the two of them, but with the roles reversed. So instead of it being Cena as the ultimate good guy and Punk as kind of the in-between guy, even though people were still cheering for him, now the roles are reversed, and you can have a whole series of new matches. I mean, they could have a program that goes through the first half of 2012. But they also had plans for The Rock to come back, and so that, you know, how that would have impacted things, I don't know. They wanted to do that Rock Cena match. That Rock Cena match did big business, you know, so maybe it was just a matter of bad timing. But that still doesn't mean that they didn't handle the Punk stuff the right way. They absolutely cooled him off way too quick. So if I can go back in time and change something, that's what I would change. The streak, it is what it is. It's, looking back, not that big of a deal. But the Punk stuff, they left a lot of money on the table. And who knows, maybe he'd still be with the company today had they played their cards right. Jose from Boston. When two top wrestlers feud for a long time, usually their final matches are a disappointment. For example, Steve Austin and The Undertaker feuded every year from 1997 to 2002, with the exception of 2000 because Austin was out with neck surgery, and their match at Backlash 2002 was not a very good match at all, with Ric Flair as the special guest referee. Another match, or another feud rather, was Shawn Michaels and Triple H. They feuded from the summer of 02 all the way until Bad Blood 2004, and their Hell in a Cell match was also a disappointment, and that one went almost 50 minutes. What other examples can you think of? Yeah, I didn't like that Hell in a Cell match either. Some people think it's the best one they ever did. I think those people are out of their mind. You know, look, just because it went 47 minutes or whatever it was does not make it a great match. I thought it got very boring as it went on. I might say Bret Hart and Steve Austin. I think their last singles match may have been at that In Your House the month after their famous WrestleMania match. So that would have been like April of 97. I think that was the Revenge of the Taker show. You know, it wasn't a bad match, but it was definitely the worst of the three pay-per-view matches they had. And it ended in a DQ. So that was kind of a disappointment to think that was the last time the two of them had a big match one-on-one against each other. And it was the worst of the bunch. Hogan and Andre, yeah, to be honest, all of their matches sucked. But that WrestleMania 4 match where both of them got DQ'd was pretty damn bad. you know, at least the WrestleMania 3 match, at least the match they had on NBC where Hogan finally lost the championship, those matches were historically significant. That match at WrestleMania 4 was just a total waste. Rock and Austin, you could say Rock and Austin maybe, right? I mean, I'm not really a big fan of that last match they had at WrestleMania 19. I'd probably rank it third out of the three Mania matches that they had. I've actually warmed up a bit to their match at WrestleMania 15 as time has gone on. I used to not really like it that much, but I've warmed up to it. But that also, I think, had a lot to do with Austin's physical state at that time in 03. You know, there's a reason why that was his last match. I think that has a lot to do with these matches being disappointing in the end, to be honest with you. I mean, usually so much time has gone by. If you're talking about a feud that's gone on for years, okay, not months, so much time has gone by that they're older, they're more beat up, there just isn't a story there like there may have been for their earlier matches. So it doesn't feel as epic. I will say, John Cena and CM Punk are two guys who kind of bucked that trend. That last match they had together on Raw before WrestleMania 29 is a number one contenders match. That was a damn good match. That was a pay-per-view caliber match. You take that match, you put that in the main event slot of any pay-per-view at that time, and people wouldn't think any less of it. It would have fit right in there perfectly. That's an example of two guys who I think ended their feud on a high note. That was the last match they ever had together. And in my opinion, they went out on a high note. Because I'll put that match up against any of the other matches that they've had. I mean, their Money in the Bank match in 2011 is still my favorite one. But that match on Raw, every bit as good as any of their best matches. Steven from Wisconsin. Buy or sell. Kevin Owens and Mark Henry as a tag team called O. Henry. Now, come on now. Let's not give them any ideas. Actually, that reminds me of when they didn't know what to do with Billy Gunn or Big Show. This would have been like 2001, 2002. So they put them together and they called them Shogun. I guess that was someone's idea of a joke. It didn't last long. Nor would O. Henry if they put the two of them together. And we'll end with this more serious buy or sell. This is from John from California. Buy or sell, Vince McMahon as the announcer, or Vince McMahon as Mr. McMahon, the evil corporate promoter? See, this one's at least easier than the Shawn Michaels one last week, which was maybe one of the hardest questions I've ever had to answer here on the show. This one's a little bit easier. I'm going to go with Vince as the evil promoter, Mr. McMahon. I was a fan of Vince McMahon, the announcer. Some people think he sucked. Yes, he didn't know the names of a lot of the moves. Everything was, oh, what a maneuver. And he would do this thing where every time somebody went for a pin, he would think it was three. He'd be like, one, two, we got him. No, he didn't. That was just a staple of his commentary. I think it was kind of endearing. It kind of just, that was a sign of Vince McMahon commentary. That was his trademark. But I thought Vince McMahon was a great commentator. You know, I mean, he was great in his own way. He was the owner of the company, so he knew all the stories. He knew what he wanted to get over, who he wanted to get over, what to highlight, what not to highlight. And I thought he was great. I don't think he gets enough credit for being as great of an announcer as he was. I think people make the mistake of comparing him to, like, Jim Ross or Gordon Solie. Well, Jim Ross and Gordon Solie were a totally different kind of announcer, right? If you compare them as, okay, did Vince know the names of the moves and know the sports backgrounds and the athletic backgrounds and the college backgrounds? Like, no, he didn't know hardly any of that. So they're not exactly the same kind of announcer. I think it's kind of unfair to compare. But on his own, as a play-by-play guy trying to get over the stories and get over the talent, and when something heinous happened, there was nobody better except maybe Jim Ross than Vince McMahon. It just portraying this disgust on his face and this disgust in his voice with what he had just seen. He was great, but I don't see how you can put Vince the announcer over Vince the evil promoter, because it was Vince the evil promoter that set them off on that course of great success that they had. You know, people talk about Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper, what would happen if you had one without the other? Would the first WrestleMania have worked? And how Piper was so instrumental in the career of Hogan. Well, guess what? Not just because he was the actual promoter pushing Austin and giving him the chance that WCW never did. As the Mr. McMahon character, you take him away, I don't know how easily and how quickly Steve Austin gets out. He was already over, so it's not like he would have been unsuccessful. But do things reach that kind of zenith that they did in 98, 99? Because it was all about Austin McMahon. That thing went on for years. Everything that Austin did, it all led back to Vince McMahon. So that's how key that character was to Austin. One without the other, I don't know how well that works out. You got that Hogan-Piper dynamic there. And not to mention the fact that, you know, Vince McMahon as the promoter character, I would argue that that Mr. McMahon character may have been the greatest heel in WWE history. And is on that list as one of the all-time great heels in wrestling history. But certainly in his company, if you were to make a list of the all-time greatest heels, I might put him at number one. Find me somebody who was better. I mean, yeah, he did wrestle, but he wasn't a wrestler, so he wasn't in the ring a lot. True. It's a little maybe unfair to compare him to somebody like a Roddy Piper, who actually was not a heel for very long in WWE. I mean, he's one of the all-time great heels. But if you really look at his run, how long was Piper really a heel for? He spent a long time off and on in WWE. He left, he came back, he left, he came back. So when you add everything up, I mean, maybe he does get like 15 years out of his career there. I don't know what the total number of years is that he spent there. But his time as a heel is just a tiny portion of it. Vince McMahon is that heel character. He was so freaking good. I mean, just so believable as an asshole. And maybe Montreal helped a lot because people could buy into the fact that this guy was an asshole. But his facial expressions, his promos, holy shit. One of the best promo guys in the history of his own company. How could you not put him in your top 10 list? I mean, he was awesome. Everything he did, he was so great. That Mr. McMahon character is just, it's incredible what he was able to do, which is amazing for as many years as he sat out there as the announcer and the guy that Jerry Lawler would make fun of and he would mock him, hey, you're wearing a toupee, McMahon, where's your toupee? And I mean, to go from that to what he became and to be as good at it, you kind of saw flashes of it. If you go back on YouTube, I hope the videos are still up. He had a little bit of fun in 93. He did some shots for Jerry Lawler in his USWA promotion down in Memphis where he was. That was the first time we saw the heel Mr. McMahon character. It wasn't in 1997. It wasn't in 1998. It was in 1993. He made, I think, one appearance in Memphis, but he would send in promos. So he actually recorded a whole bunch of promos. These were just unbelievable to watch because as a younger fan back then, I had no idea this ever happened until many years later. I stumbled upon it on YouTube. I'm like, what the hell is this? Mr. McMahon in Memphis, you know, 5 years before anybody even knew the character existed. It's pretty cool to go back and watch. I mean, it's obvious he was having a lot of fun doing it, and he was honing his craft. Little did he know he would have a chance to portray that character on his own TV many years later. I don't think he would have predicted that. But yeah, I think that Mr. McMahon character, in all honesty, will go down as one of, if not the greatest heel in WWE history. And of the two, as much as I love Vince the Announcer, I got to buy on Mr. McMahon and sell on Vince the Announcer if you force me to make a choice. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep sending them in to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send me, even if I don't have a chance to respond. I assure you I do read it. So you can hit me up there. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, especially if you're going to be at TakeOver in Brooklyn tonight. If you see me, say hello. Hope to meet some of you guys there. And you can follow me along on there as well. I'll be live tweeting during the show tonight, during SummerSlam tomorrow night, Raw every Monday as usual. So @Solomonster is my handle. We are on Facebook as well. This would be a good time to get in on the discussion group on Facebook. There'll be a lot of discussion going on this weekend, I'm sure. Facebook.com/TheSolemonster is my profile page, but to search for the private group, you have to apply for membership. Type in the full name of the podcast in the search bar on Facebook. From the drop-down, you should see the fan page and the group. If not, you know, send me a message if we're already friends. I may have to manually add you to the group. But you can get in on that. And also, don't forget, subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheSolemonster, because there's going to be at least one new video going up in the next few days, probably a SummerSlam review sometime Monday afternoon. I may do a separate video. I'll post that possibly Tuesday morning, maybe, with my NXT TakeOver thoughts. Either way, there's some new content going up, so subscribe if you are not already a subscriber. Buy the new Whistling Dixie shirt. Sign up for Audible using our link. These are just a couple of different ways to keep supporting this podcast. If you like what you hear each and every week, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Or you can make a PayPal donation at all times on thesolomonster.com. Thank you for your support. Everybody who's been donating, I very much appreciate that. Back with more content on YouTube in a few days and a brand new Sound Off, episode 398, next weekend. In the meantime, enjoy TakeOver, ROH, SummerSlam, whatever other shows you may be attending. And I'll see you right back here next week. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.